This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're not for anything else but air, water, and people not being poor and getting to go to work, right? There's no other agenda. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the challenge for the environmental movement and for us is that the attack is so strong because what's so smart is it's personal.
Political opponents of the green movement have been depressingly successful, not only in attacking the facts that underpin the struggle, but in knocking down some of its most eloquent and powerful figures, relegating to the margins what should be a universal concern, a healthy world that can be sustained into the future. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Phaedra Ellis Lampkins, one of those eloquent and powerful figures. In spite of personal attacks from those who would silence her, Ms. Ellis Lampkins perseveres in the fight to nurture a green economy that helps to empower traditionally disenfranchised communities. Picking up where Van Jones left off, Ms. Ellis Lampkins is the Chief Executive Officer of Green for All, which works to promote the green economy through policy advocacy, networking, engagement of the business community, and by mentoring a new generation of environmentalists of color. She talks about the challenges of breaking into a field dominated by white middle-class men, how issues of urban poverty and the environment are inextricably tied, and what needs to happen to change the makers and takers narrative that pits ideological rhetoric against our shared need for global health. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Phaedra Ellis Lampkins. She's the CEO of Green for All, which is a nonprofit focused on green jobs. Phaedra, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
In a few sentences, tell us the mission of Green for All. We've had Van Jones on this show before. This is the organization that he founded. But just remind our listeners what Green for All is devoted to.
Well, we're an organization that our tagline is working to build a green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. But really what we're trying to figure out is the planet's in crisis and the economy's in crisis, how do you find solutions that make both better?
In terms of real-world solutions, how does that translate?
Well, I think of it in the fact that, you know, where I grew up in a community, there was, a lot of people, working class people, who had to find jobs. And so most of us and our families worked in plants. And what we discovered is that those were the places where there was high rates of pollution. You know, I lived near Sheldon Oil, which was right near water, and there was oil in the water. And when I heard of environmentalists or I saw environmentalists, they were kind of the people that came in our community and said our jobs weren't good. And so what we're trying to figure out at Green for All is how do you build jobs that those communities need, but that they don't destroy the communities that people live in? You know, it took me a while. I thought, oh, these environmentalists are people that come in and they tell our communities that they can't work. And then what I realized is it was actually really sad that where I grew up, I didn't think that we had a choice to have good environment and good jobs. And so really our mission at Green for All is to make sure that the future generation recognizes that no matter where you're born, no matter who you are, no matter where you live, you have a right to have good jobs and an environment that you can breathe in.
It seems like organizations like yours are a perfect confluence of the manufacturing infrastructure sector that politicians like to harken back to when they're talking about what made America great and what built America. And sometimes the stereotyping of environmentalists as tree huggers and environmental projects. But green jobs is a perfect confluence of that in a lot of ways, isn't it? And how do you think your organization can kind of help spread that message?
Well, first, I think we want to be able to show people practically how it works, right? Van and I joke that he was rhetoric and I'm reality, right? He would say, here's my grand vision, which is really an important vision to say that there can be an intersection between the environment and people of color and people looking for work. And so he really did a clear, important vision. But what we now try to do is to focus on reality. So where do those jobs exist? What do they look like? So for example, you and I are sitting here in San Francisco, and here we've been partnering with the Public Utilities Commission, essentially the people responsible for bringing water into people's homes and businesses, trying to figure out how do you make sure that the jobs that are created by building water infrastructure actually go to people that live in those communities, that it's not just about water quality, though that's really important for us. It's about green buildings, the way that things are built is green, but that also those jobs are really important jobs. And we consider it a success when you see people from every community saying, we want clean water, not just because we want water that is clean, but because we think there's a way for people to get jobs. And that's really our vision.
And the nuts and bolts of a water infrastructure initiative like the one you're discussing, how do your organization's efforts play a part? Do you lobby on behalf of trying to push forward more of these infrastructure programs, or are you working more on the employment side of things?
Well, we do both. We're a national organization, so there's a couple of places and cities where we go very deep, and we try to figure out how do you make water projects work. But what we spend most of our time doing is scaling. So if you thought about us as a business, you'd think part of us was research and development, building a model, except in this case, it's building a model for green jobs. And then most of the organization figures out how do you make that model go big. So it means we go to different national and we figure out how do you pass federal policy. We go to states and pass statewide policy. And then we go to communities and figure out how do you actually make it work. So most of our team does essentially policy, making the stuff possible, and then program and communications to make sure that those things actually exist.
I mean, this is a very large endeavor. What kind of headcount does Green for All have? And obviously, you partner with lots of different organizations. Maybe you can walk us through that umbrella if you can.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a good-sized team, but part of what's been really important is investing in people who are in communities in addition to our staff. So we have two types of programs. One, a fellowship program, which is people who are doing everything from a woman who is in the Bronx building a mobile market so that they have a bus that they can actually run that brings groceries into the Bronx, to someone that's putting solar on his roof in a church in Denver. And so we have a couple hundred of these fellows that we coordinate work with who are doing amazing work, which has added an incredible amount of capacity. The second thing is we have ambassadors, people who are on college campuses, who figure out what are the projects that they can do and how do they spread the message, which has been important. So someone at Howard University created one of the first bicycle sharing programs. And so I think our staff is important, but far more important has been our connection to real people in their own communities. We have a lot of partners, and our partners are everyone from 350.org, who we love and adore, to local folks, to people who are running businesses. And so we've been really lucky. It's probably only in the last couple of years where our kind of fantasy vision has been really critically attacked. And I think a sign of the success is that people started fighting back, because what we realize is if you get people of color together, if you get environmentalists together, if you have people sharing a vision that delivers on jobs and a better community, that's a pretty powerful coalition.
As a woman of color in the environmental movement, have you seen, maybe share some of the challenges that you faced and what makes you hopeful that women of color will become more and more of a leading voice in the environmental movement? And maybe on the flip side, is there some signs of discouragement as well?
Well, you know, I was in the labor movement, and I have to say the labor movement was far more diverse than the environmental movement, which was shocking to me. What has been most shocking to me is, in some ways, it is what I imagined more conservative movements would look like. Definitely not feel, definitely not policy.
A lot of white guys.
Or people who've just known each other since grade school, right? Like, you remember in 1972, we were working on the Chesapeake Bay campaign, and then...
So it's an old boys
network. It definitely is. And also, what's been somewhat surprising is that when you have one group, you tend to have groupthink. You tend to have, this is the ideas we have, this is what we think. And I'm scared for the environmental movement, because the warriors that I see on the ground are people of color. They're poor people who are trying to figure out how to make their communities better, in addition to amazing people trying to save parks in their communities. But there's a lot of people of color and a lot of poor people really trying to make their communities better. And that we don't have a movement that recognizes those people exist is frightening. I mean, the thing that I realized when I came to the environmental movement, that there was an environmental justice movement that was incredibly rich and vibrant, but was really about changing the environmental movement. And to me, the fact that a movement had to have a counter challenge within the same movement was somewhat shocking to me. And as a woman of color, you know, I don't know that I would recommend that the other women of color leap. I think there's a desperate need for women of color in the environmental movement and people of color. But I would just make sure that people built a team outside of the environmental movement that kept them strong and clear so that they were really prepared.
Listen, Rome was not built in a day. Opposition will come your way. But the hotter the battle you see, is the sweeter the victory. Now, you can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Phaedra Ellis-Lampkins. She's the CEO of Green for All. Do you think there's any advantage in terms of tapping into different pockets of energy and dollars than the traditional the Green Pieces and the Sierra Clubs of the world that are all kind of vying for those same dollars?
You know, I think I'll give you an example. We were raising money and from a large foundation, and the foundation said to us, whatever you do, don't mention people of color and poor people in your proposal, and then we think you'll get funded.
What was their rationale for that?
It was just like, we think it'll be difficult to get funded that way. And so to me,
because like, they didn't want it to look like a charity case.
Right. I don't know. Or did they just, that wasn't kind of where they were going? So to me that, you know, in most other progressive worlds, if someone said you don't mention people of color and poor people, it would be somewhat shocking.
And people maybe would mildly feel, offensive. Right.
Not mildly, but yeah. Certainly offensive.
Yeah.
And so to me, the fact that those kind of conversations exist is shocking to me still. But I think what we've been able to do at Green for All, I hope, is to create space for leaders of color to provide support. And also there's incredible leaders, you know, Bob Bullard, there's folks who've been doing this far longer than we have, but the idea that we can create space, which is why our fellows, it's why the ambassadors on historically Black colleges and universities are really important, because I just don't know how we win comprehensive climate change reform or the things that we want without people of color. And I think when we have significant victories in places like California, it's because there's a coalition. It's that because people of color and poor people and working people go together with traditional environmentalists, that's when change happens. That's why we believe in our mission.
Just to step back for a second, you think of some of the more well-known environmental voices of the last 100 years, from Teddy Roosevelt to, it's usually naturalists and,
right.
and people in the John Muir mm-hmm. mold who want to take nature walks and enjoy natural beauty and want clean water to fish in and things like that. But there's a desperate need in poor communities. It's not just a luxury to be able to go for a nice nature walk. They need clean water and clean air in places like Richmond, California, where they're under the shadow of these smokestacks from mm-hmm. the Chevron refinery. So you would think that there's a real desperate need to fill in these communities where people want to get involved. And it's just a question of diverting that energy just into the word job and into combining environment and jobs.
No, I think that's right. And when we think about the fact that not only are people, the air that people are breathing when African Americans and Latino kids are 6 to 10 times more likely to get asthma because they live 30 miles within a coal plant, or the fact that the numbers of unemployment, but you know, the thing that is just incredibly shocking to me is that, you know, there's cities right now where it is still an incredible challenge for people to get clean water in their faucets, right? We were talking in Texas where people didn't have water for 3 or 4 days, or where I live in Fairfield, I was visiting someone about 20 minutes away when they said, just don't drink the tap water. And so the idea that the water infrastructure in this country isn't strong enough so that people get clean and fresh water, and that in most places, a bottle of water is more expensive to buy than a soda, is shocking, right? Because what that means is that in those communities and in our communities, there's going to be an incredible crisis where the reason people are drinking soda, it's cheaper to buy soda. When I moved from Washington, D.C. back home, and I walked into a store and I realized it was cheaper for me to buy a soda than a bottle of water, something's wrong with that. Something's fundamentally wrong with that.
Especially if you're hungry.
Right.
And you're like, well, I can get 200 extra calories this way. But there's some. That's how we get into this cycle of obesity as well,
right.
Which seems like some of the work that Michelle Obama is doing and the food movement in general. We profiled the Berkeley School Lunch Program.
Oh,
and it seems like that's another touchstone area for urban poor and environmental needs to kind of meet.
Yeah, I have to say this. I moved home and I've gained a significant amount of weight personally since I moved home. And what's been interesting to me is that when I was living in other communities, I could walk to a really great grocery store. I could take a hike. The community was organized. I had to walk places because there was public transportation. So I took a bike everywhere. I lived in Washington, D.C. before. So I didn't even own a car when I was in Washington, D.C. I couldn't live here without a car. I couldn't go to a grocery store and get inexpensive, healthy food. And so it's been really frightening to me, you know, going into different grocery stores. And the reason I say the soda versus water is because communities aren't being built to actually allow people to be healthy. It's much easier to be unhealthy. And that's been shocking for me to realize. Because in some ways, when you grow up and you go to cities, you're like, oh, this is all personal choice. People just have to make better choices. And then you go somewhere and you go, oh, yeah,
There's no option.
I can't go. Even things, basic things like being able to just stretch. And I mean, it's just been shocking to realize how much the way that communities are planned is how you live instead of how much you plan. Because I think it feels very personal when you're in places that have a lot of resources.
Basically, this is the way most Americans live, the majority at least. And it's built on the dream of cheap oil and the automobile and the GI Bill and just building out farther and farther from these urban centers. And it seems like there's movements like yours which are helping to try to reverse that trend.
We've been, but you know what's even scarier to me is that what's happening is upper and middle income people are moving back into centers of urban areas.
And pricing people out.
Right, and people are getting pressed out. And the problem is all of the problems of pollution and other things existed, but it's going to get exacerbated because then you have people who no longer have access to public transportation, who no longer have access to grocery stores or resources. And so I think that, you know, we've been trying to essentially chart what we're calling pollution migration, that the problems in the cities that were bad are going to become even worse because they're all just being pushed out to the suburbs that were already not doing great, but now they're going to be in crisis.
And I'm not intimately familiar with the city, and I'm not sure if you are either, but kind of on the flip side, you have something like Detroit, which is, by all accounts, turned into almost a wasteland. There's just prices have gone through the floor. It's just it's a metropolitan area, but there's no there, so to speak. Do you see a role for organizations like Green for All to be able to make a change in these kind of communities? Where do you see the evolution or de-evolution of cities like Detroit?
I think what's hard about places like Detroit is that's where we see what you talked about earlier, the basis for manufacturing kind of middle-class jobs, that when that leaves, it's a shock for that community because there's not a jobs center, but you still have all the problems that existed, right? So if you still have all the stuff left from manufacturing but none of the jobs, it's a real crisis. And we were just in a room with the folks from Detroit, and they were saying just to get their stormwater, their water system working, at the rate they're fixing it, it would take 400 years. So you look at a place where water's going to be a problem relatively soon. There's not a job center. And you see people moving out of the cities and the price becoming incredibly cheap. And so people just move away. And so, you know, for us, places like Detroit are the things that we're trying to figure out because it's the most important part, I think, of this economy. What we're having trouble with is the scale of problem is so significant for an organization like ours. And so we invest in a couple of cities. We haven't made a significant investment in Detroit because we've been essentially identifying other cities. And the thing that's always surprising to me is we were invited lovingly by a couple of amazing groups in Detroit. We've not had the capacity. But there's a desperate need for support because there's amazing people doing really good work trying to make sure that their city stays strong.
this land of broken dreams. I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an illusion filled with sadness and confusion. What becomes of the broken hearted who had love that's now departed? I know I've got to find some kind of peace of mind, maybe.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Phaedra Ellis-Lampkins. She's the CEO of Green for All. Phaedra, let's turn to politics for a second and the political challenges that organizations like yours face trying to go up against some of the richest corporations in the world. And they've had a 50-year head start on organizations like yours to try to create a very unlevel playing field. Why don't you walk us through some of the methods that are most effective for a grassroots organization to try to level the playing field?
So I think first it's important to give the context of what they're doing to attack. So for us, most consistently, it's been Fox News putting our pictures on the boards. I think we were all happy when Glenn Beck went to pay for radio and internet. And
I'm sorry, what did you, pictures on the boards? What does
so
that mean?
If you, it means you don't watch Fox News. But if you do, they have a chalkboard and they put essentially the enemies of the state on this board so people know who they are. So they put your photo up with like 30 other people and they'll just tell everyone why you're a bad person. So then you get hate mail and crazy stuff. So I think it's important to understand that these aren't people who are just saying, I disagree with you. They actually put your photo up and make it very personal. And so I think what's different about the political discourse is that it is not just a disagreement about ideas. It's a very personal attack. And they make serious accusations. And so what that means is for us, the most important thing we can do is be clear about our values, engage a lot of people at communities so that it is not just an attack on an individual, but it's really an attack on the kind of values that we have, which is why it's so important to be able to say, here's where we've delivered this many jobs in a place like Portland. We can say, look, these people went to work, so that you don't just disagree with me, you disagree with the people who are getting jobs. And we're going to Sacramento right now. We're going and we're saying, look, here's a place where this many people got jobs. Here's how the environment looks better. And so probably the most important thing has been connecting with people in communities so that there's a real example, being clear about our values, being transparent about our work, and really fighting back when it becomes necessary. But I want to be very clear that it's really hard. I mean, the first time I got a letter at my house from somebody who was like, you're the socialist devil of the world.
And you're like,
how'd you get my home address, right? And you wrote me a note, someone dropped something off at my house. And so it's really important to just be very clear that it is not just like we're having a discourse. It's actually really serious. And I don't think everyone gets that the fight for our air and water is that serious.
It's pretty strange that people would not be able to see the trees through the forest, so to speak.
Right. It's like we're not for anything else but air, water, and people not being poor and getting to go to work. Right? There's no other agenda. And, you know, sometimes I feel like the challenge for the environmental movement and for us is that the attack is so strong because what's so smart is it's personal, right? It's not because how do you say, oh, those crazy Green for All, they want everyone to go to work and breathe the air they live in and work in. I mean, that just must
be insanity.
That's a crazy agenda. So you have to say, oh, that Phaedra, oh, that Van Jones. And so that part just feels very serious. And I don't know that anyone in our movement has taken it seriously enough.
If we take the 2008 and then 2012 elections and you look at, it was the drill baby drill insanity of 2008, but by 2012, the summer, it became, we built this, and it's the makers versus the takers.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to change that narrative is really important because, yes, this may involve some government spending, but it's in order to get people back to work, people who want to make things, mm-hmm. not people who want to take things. And that's, but it seems like the two sides of this coin have kind of calcified. And one is we got to cut government spending, we got to get government out of our business. And the other is we need to activate this economy and get people back to work in energy efficiency and other important ways to try to clean up our natural resources and become more productive as a society.
You know, I'm so interested in this issue, the kind of makers and takers, because what scares me in this moment, and I don't sometimes feel like we're doing enough, is that the country is becoming so divided on really issues that used to be pretty basic.
For example?
For water, air, right? So if you look at air and water, it used to be that it wasn't just environmentalists, but it was hunters and fishers and people who wanted to be outdoors. I mean, if you think about the fact that Nixon established the Environmental Protection Agency, right? It wasn't radical leftists who established the EPA.
Passed the Clean Water
Act. Right, passed the Clean Water Act, right? And the fact that those issues about air and water are now divisive and radical is frightening. And so the thing I think that we're going to have to figure out, and then I spend my nights literally up worried about, is how do we actually talk clearly and crisply about the fact that we just want air and water? And it's why I think for us, Green for All, our mission is so important, is because I think when people are in crisis, which so many Americans are right now, because they're just trying to stay in their homes, keep their jobs, figure out how to make it so that they can make sure the kids have a better life, that you can't just be talking about something that feels like forever when people aren't able to meet their most urgent critical needs. And so I think that's the part that we're trying to figure out, because in the absence of the environmental movement recognizing that many people in this country are in crisis and not part of an economic recovery, we can't just be talking about air and water. We have to recognize where people are right now.
Now, we've been talking about some of the big picture ideas behind organizations like yours. Mm-hmm. On a more granular level, if you can walk us through some people who've benefited from the work that you mm-hmm. do.
Well, so this is my favorite part, because it's actually the most enjoyable to talk about. So we have different levels. We basically are just trying to create as many examples of the green economy and try to make it go as far and wide as possible. So that looks differently. It is people who have businesses. So it is Mann and Mark Davis in Washington, D.C., who has created a solar manufacturing firm that's being built in Anacostia in Washington, D.C. It is a woman in Chicago, and what we do is, for those folks, we actually run a business academy so that people can learn how do you run the business, what support do you need, what opportunities exist, and then we have a coaching program with Accenture so people can figure out how to access capital and other things. Then in terms of actual job creation, it might be like Portland, we talked about a little bit earlier, where we partnered around energy efficiency to create energy efficiency, and 300 people now have jobs. A woman started a construction company, and so that you actually see people go into work in jobs that allow them to support their families, have health care. There's a woman in New York, one of my favorite videos I ever saw, we get a lot of feedback from people, is a woman saying, not only do I have a job, but now I actually am taking care of the planet. And that's what we're trying to figure out. Like, how do single moms who are trying to support their families get jobs that they can support their families, but also get to help take care of our planet?
She's the CEO of Green for All, Phaedra Ellis Lampkins. Phaedra, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Cesaria Evora, Desmond Decker, and Jimmy Ruffin.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.